Welcome to Full Prefrontal, the show that exposes the mysteries of executive function. This podcast is a collection of conversations about the role of the prefrontal cortex, which impacts your focus, planning, problem solving, emotional balance, and independence. So join us as we explore executive function and the science of learning. And now, here's your host, the founder of EXQ, Sucheta Kamath.
Welcome back to Full Prefrontal, Exposing the Mysteries of Executive Function. I'm your host, Sucheta Kamath, and every week we talk about interesting topics pertinent to personal self-management, helping children, adolescent, and even young adults to manage their goals, manage their mission, and most importantly, how do we all persist towards our goals through passage of time, through arduous roadblocks that we encounter on an everyday basis? One of the topics that has interested me deeply is sense of motivation. I am currently interviewing somebody for a job, and as part of their interview, they were saying, I'm highly motivated. I'm a self-starter. I get things done without anybody cajoling me. And some of the examples she gave, I thought were very, very funny. She said, I do not, when I get out of bed, I always make my bed. You know, if I say to somebody, I will call you on Thursday at 9 o'clock, I am there to call them Thursday at 9 o'clock. And that was so fascinating and so inviting to hear somebody talk about their motivation and their ability to persist and pursue the motivations that they have, that it just reminded me all my 25 years of career I have spent working with people who are highly unmotivated, and people in their environment and their surroundings, such as parents, teachers, educators, colleagues, are saying this person needs to change, and somehow that you can't find means to change them. So with that in mind, it was such an honor to introduce you all to a world-renowned expert in motivation. And it's my personal pleasure to introduce you to Eilert Fischbach. She is the Jeffrey Breckenridge Keller Professor of Behavioral Science and Marketing at the University of Chicago Booth School of Business, and the author of Get It Done, Surprising Lessons from the Science of Motivation. We'll be linking that book. And one of the interesting things about the title of the book you have three words that she has written on the title, which is forget, quit, undone. And then the parts of the words are canceled. I thought that was a very clever way to get people to think about how to overcome the challenges we face every day as we think about managing our goals and motivation. She is the past president of the Society for the Science of Motivation and the International Social Cognition Network. She's an expert on motivation and decision-making. Dr. Fischbach's groundbreaking research on human motivation has won the Society of Experimental Psychologists Best Dissertation Award and Career Trajectory Award and Fulbright Educational Foundation Award. She is a celebrated speaker, author. Her articles can be read many, many places, and she is highly influential in helping us think about our own understanding or lack thereof of motivation and our ways of improving our lives. So welcome to the podcast. How are you today?
Wow, thank you, Sucheta. That was a wonderful introduction. I feel like I should quit now. I'm well. I'm very happy to be here today.
Well, for starters, I thought I often ask my guests about their executive function. Executive function, as you know, entails adaptive flexibility, goal assessment, intentional focus, goal-directed persistence. In short, executive function is the CEO of the brain that governs or gives order to the rest of the brain to get things done and achieve what it wants. So for starters, I was wondering if you could share, when you were younger as a child, maybe elementary, middle school, or high school, how were your own executive function skills? And did you gain any insight about your own intentions about learning and figuring out your ways at an early age or later on in your life?
That's an interesting question. I don't think that I really paid any attention executive education or being a good student until college, really.
Really? Like
I was okay. But first I grew up in Israel, in a community that is very different than where I am now. So it was a small community, a socialist community where we walked the land and had farming and animals and so on. So education was not that much of a center of anybody's life. I wasn't in particular interested in what was going on in school until I got to college. And you know, maybe I was interested enough because obviously like I did well enough to get into college and do things there, but it was really not intrinsically motivated until I started to study psychology. And then it was like, wow, that's exciting. And that's like interesting. You really can't, you read like these like handbooks when you just start to study psychology and you're like, you can't wait to have another hour to know what's more there's there, okay, and how else people can ask a question and look for data and run studies and develop knowledge. So I probably had a decent executive education. Reflecting back, I was able to,
yes,
able to get a PhD and then a job and you know and like that. Do well enough to hold my career for 20 years now. But I didn't realize that until I had the chance to do something which is intrinsically motivating. And I would say that because I think that often when you think that you cannot do something, you might be confusing that with, I am not interested. Okay, that's not the right thing for me.
You know, as you were describing your own trajectory, it kind of reminds me of my personal education in India as well. Education was important, but it was not central. Like you were not free of responsibility. And, you know, I mean, I remember in my house, the rule was whether you had board exams or you had a quiz, you still had to set the table, clean up after your dinner. You had to do dishes. You had to sweep and mop if that was what your parents asked, and then get to studying. So now what I find, parents are feeding their children because the kids are studying for a test. I mean, hand feeding a high schooler. I had a client who did that. And so I find this, everything else becomes a secondary because you somehow are getting good grades. I think sounds like your executive function skills were very well put to test as well as utilized by you because you were doing managing communal responsibilities. So as we begin here, maybe you can set us off with a good definition of motivation, because I think colloquial wisdom says motivation is getting things done, having this desire to get things done. But maybe that's missing something, right?
It's kind of accurate. Motivation is power, okay? And it's the internal power that you have, which gets you to move from where you are to a different place. Okay, so you have goals, and we all have goals. Okay, we have goals related to our professional development, academic development, our health, our relationship. And motivation is what gets you to pursue these goals, okay? What gets you out of bed and into the gym shoes or in front of your study materials. It's really the inner force, the inner power.
You know what's so interesting about that? You're saying having a goal is not enough. Having a goal is a starting point, but that needs to be propelled by actions, which is what motivations helps us get into. Correct?
Yes. And, you know, part of being motivated is knowing how to set your goals. But it's definitely not enough. It's just the first part. And motivation itself is the power to get there. Okay. It's how you organize yourself and your life. And as I say that, I realize that it may sound like you are by yourself, getting yourself to do things. That would be a limited view of motivation, because motivation is often involved at designing the environment, designing the situation in which I can better achieve my goal. And if that sounds abstract, well, you exercise your motivation every time you set an alarm clock. Okay, basically, you know that you are going to be tired when you need to get up in the morning, and that you will continue to sleep if you are in a cozy, dark room. But if there was a loud alarm, that is going to change your situation, and likely you will get up to do something about it. And so you are motivating yourself by anticipating that there is a problem, changing something about the environment, and therefore being able to stick to your goal.
And I love that. I think your work really highlights the role of environment. I think, when we were discussing in pre-recording that there's a misnomer, or colloquial wisdom says motivation is all about determination from within. But there are environmental factors that can actually act as guardrails that can allow us to not keel over and forget our goals or get off tangent as we are pursuing goals. So maybe you can share with us, for starters, we often hear intrinsic and extrinsic motivation, so that one comes from within, one is motivated by incentives and external goals. Is that a good place to start? And how would you describe the types of motivation that we all experience?
So there is a lot to unpack in your question. First, I do want to emphasize that motivation is about changing your environment. It's about changing your circumstances. You started with an example of a person saying, I'm highly motivated. Well, while there are individual differences, some people might be in general more motivated than others. It's often a function of where you are and what is the thing that you set to do. And so my example was that I was in particular a highly motivated student in high school. And then I discovered psychology in college and became super motivated. Okay, so it was about the challenge, about the environment, about the people I was with, and the new topics that I was introduced to. And I would very much reject the idea that people say, I'm not motivated. Well, you know, you did not find the thing, or you did not design the environment that gets you to act.
Can I quickly share a story with you? You know, I was on a flight from Atlanta to India, which is a connected flight, and the India leg from, I think, Paris or whatever, the entire time there was a leak above my seat, and my right shoulder kept getting completely drenched with this ice cold water. And so I called the flight attendant, you know, and asked and requested a change of seat. The flight was packed. There was nothing they could do. She was so stressed and stretched that she was not even empathic towards me. I was getting a little annoyed with her. Ultimately, there was 9 hours of flight. I was just plotting, like the whole time I plotted that I'm going to send an email to Delta. I'm going to complain. I'm going to be so mad, and I'm going to tell them I'm going to ask for a refund. Then I landed and my family came to the gate to welcome me, and I completely forgot. And I completely lost my vengeance, my plot, my email, and I just became unimportant. And so I see that you're talking about this environmental embedded cue. It was very frustrating, but it was not that important to me to actually pursue a complaint.
Yeah, I love this story. You know, it probably would have been better for future people on the flight if you complain. So if your anger led to action, but for your well-being, you were in a different situation, and the anger was gone and replaced with love to your family. And now you are a different person pursuing different goals and very happy with doing that. And so, you know, we all can identify situations where we just cannot do something, and then other situations in which we are doing just fine and we need to organize our lives so that we are importing that the factors that help us to stay motivated, to get things done, to the areas where we feel stuck, we are unable to do it. And then you're asking about intrinsic motivation. Intrinsic motivation is a very confusing concept in motivation science. And you know, I can get into the whole confusion. People say intrinsic motivation, they mean different things. Okay, economists mean that we don't pay you. As some people mean that it's from within as opposed to from the outside. In motivation science, intrinsic motivation is actually pursuing something as an end in itself. Okay? Is that the feeling that as I'm doing it, I'm achieving my goal, that this feels right, that the activity and the goal that it serves are fused, and we are intrinsically motivated when we are like doing something fun with our family, okay, when we are pursuing our hobbies, strolling the park, reading a great book. These experiences often feel like an end in itself. And then we are extrinsically motivated when we do something just for some long-term benefits. Okay, there is no immediate pleasure. I might go and get a medical appointment because I care about my long-term health. There is no sense that this feels right and good as I'm doing it. And then you have everything that's in between. Okay, so, you know, your exercise, morning exercise, does this feel like an end in itself or more like something that you pull through it so that you have the long-term benefits? Your work, okay, are you excited to do your job? Are you one of these people that by the end of the day, they had another 15 minutes to finish what they have started? Or are you one of those people who just can't wait for work to be over so that you can do something else? There is some in between. Okay? You can be more or less intrinsically motivated. You can more or less enjoy the thing. Okay? Or feel that it's right. Okay? I have a feeling that as you pursue the activity, you're achieving something, you are developing, you are learning, you are relaxing. Okay? Whatever it is that you are trying to achieve, it happens as you pursue the action.
You know, this is really, really helpful because I think, take examples of clinicians, therapists, and teachers, educators, parents who are tasked to help people get on board doing things that the person you're working with doesn't want to or is struggling. So it's not necessarily even doesn't want to, but may not know how to. It is such an important distinction that it feels right, may not happen for them right away. Let's say if I have reading difficulty and I have dyslexia and I'm working with a dyslexia tutor who's showing me some sound symbol relationship that I don't get it as a child, and I'm not going to enjoy it, but then I look out to my teacher's support or the care that I get. So that seems to be a starting point that gets me to a place where I see my own success, and then I can say, ah, now it feels good, right?
So yes, and learning has to be immediately gratifying, okay? And in particular for young people, for kids. We basically explore a few ways of making learning intrinsically motivated. And the one way that I think might surprise people is if we find that when we make math class a party, that is, we play music and bring colored pencils and snacks, then kids were solving more math problems. They enjoy the experience more. Now, I think that people find it confusing because in a way we brought some external things to the experience. Mm-hmm. We brought music, okay? We brought colors. But the whole class, okay, the whole event of studying math became something that it's more fun, that it has more like surprising elements, that is unusual and interesting. And that can happen in the materials. Okay? It could be that you found the right way to teach or to learn because you found type of exercises that are interesting for you, that are fun, that you're curious to solve. It could also be external. Okay, you do your homework or your tutor appointment in the most pleasant experience. There is lots of stimuli around you that make you feel in the zone, okay? Make you feel like this is right. The other way to think about how to bring intrinsic motivation to something that might not feel right, might not feel good, is to have people realize that sometimes it takes a bit of practice for something to feel good. Okay? And, you know, if you haven't been running for a while and you go on a jog, your body might hurt. Okay? But it's okay if you do this a couple of times because then you will enjoy running the way you may have enjoyed it back at the time. We looked at this in a study with Caitlin Woolley, by the way. Also, the previous study was with her, with teaching people improv. Okay? And we worked with the Second City, which is an improvisation club here at the city of Chicago. And basically, we invited people who were very new to improvisation to feel uncomfortable. Okay? We told them, your goal when you do this exercise is to feel uncomfortable. And what happened is that the discomfort that they would have experienced in any event, because if you have not done improvisation before and you're just trying it, it really pushes your limits as a person. Okay, you really feel awkward about your body and what you say and how you move. If you think about this as the goal, okay, my immediate goal today is to feel uncomfortable. Then when you feel uncomfortable, it's a sign that this is working. Okay, and you might be able to persist a little bit until it actually feels more comfortable.
Yes.
This is what we found. Like when people had the immediate goal to feel uncomfortable, they wanted to do it more so that eventually they felt more comfortable.
You know, that's again, I think it's also another counterintuitive process. You know, we think anything that challenges us should not challenge us. Then we wouldn't grow. And so it's such a good example that converting your discomfort into comfort requires you to engage with it, challenge yourself. And then once you are less confused or a process becomes more transparent, that automatically evaporates in a way. So that's pretty neat as well. You know, I think the other question that I had that, you know, that there are two motivational processes that you were describing, if I'm correct here, that, you know, outcome-focused motivation versus process-focused motivation. Can you maybe help our audience understand a little bit about these dimensions, actualize themselves differently based on the circumstances? And there are ways to, you have designed clever ways to measure that, how people, you know, how do you measure in experimental ways how motivated people are?
Yes. And so we often think about motivation in terms of doing something and do it as quickly as possible. But other times we think about it in terms of applying yourself and your standards of performance, right? And so it's important to do something. It's also important to do it right.
Yes.
And these are different dimensions of motivation. Sometimes they are aligned, like the runner that finishes the race first was obviously highly motivated to walk as quickly as possible, literally here,
yes.
And also that defined high standard of performance. But a student who's finishing the exercise very quickly might compromise the quality, right? And so you might say, well, for doing your homework, the motivation to finish it as quickly as possible is not what we are looking for. Okay, we want you to have high motivation to apply yourself, to have a high performance out of. And when we measure motivation, we really pay attention to these different dimensions. One way that Rima Tuatuluri and I looked at it was looking at what happened when people were approaching the end of the goal, when they were about to reach the goal. Okay, if what's important is doing it right, then they spend more time on the problem. Okay, they think about it more carefully. Okay, if what's important is to finish it as quickly as possible, then they spend less time. What we actually found, we gave people a series of problems to solve, and what we found is that as they reached the end, they were taking shorter breaks between each two problems. Okay? So they were more eager to get this done by taking shorter breaks. But they actually, on the very last couple of problems, spend more time getting it right, because we know that the motivation to do something right, not to cut corner, increases also as you're about to reach your goal. I would say that in the context of now education, we often need to pay attention to the motivation to do it right much more than speed. Okay, and whether the person took breaks and whether they were daydreaming a bit. Maybe because I am sometimes slow and I have like 2 out of 3 kids that tend to take their time and be slow, I learned that it really doesn't matter. Okay, you can take more time. Okay, but your performance standards should be high. Okay? You should try to apply yourself, not to cut corners.
You know, I think this so resounds with me that take example of children doing homework. So if the parents promise them that, yeah, you can, you know, play your video game for 30 minutes, you can see them whizzing through the homework while they have made a lot of mistakes. And so I think the parents find this difficult, like, how do I make them do it well and do it and then do it, get it done as quickly as they want it done so that they have time to play the video game. So I feel like some of the interesting observations you have made, maybe you can talk about that. Getting started is one aspect of motivation that operates differently versus the middle slump. When we are in the middle of pursuing a goal, we kind of lose our thunder, get bored, get tired, and then we pick up the steam again, as you just gave example seeing the end in sight. People begin to pay greater attention to the quality of outcome. So what was comforting about all that is it's a human nature. So it was very comforting that it's not just me. But I also am very curious. It's so difficult when it's not you that's involved in it. When you're in charge of other people's motivation, how can somebody, so maybe I'm asking complicated multi-layered question here, but can you talk us a little bit about these motivation landmarks influence the way we behave in the task completion differently? And how can people who support children make use of that understanding to influence the outcomes?
So, you know, the simple answer is that the same way you motivate yourself, you can motivate others. Okay, the strategies are very similar. If you know that you cannot stick to a work task that is boring, that is uninspiring, that you deal with people that you don't appreciate, then you should not expect your child to be able to work on a homework assignment that is boring for them, right? That you fail to make into a process of discovery and a process of development and a process of reassuring the child's strength. They just won't work. But beyond that, very general,
important. Yes.
Let's talk about the middle problem, basically. So we have like beginning, middle, and end, and we see that people are more motivated at the beginning and the end than in the middle. One of the cleverest studies that Rima Tuatillery, who was back then my student and I did, she's now faculty at Northwestern, was giving people a pair of scissors and a bunch of shapes on a piece of paper, okay? And what they need to do is just carefully cut these shapes, have many arrows by the order that we told them to do so. And so they are doing a great job on the first couple of shapes. The last one is also pretty good. They are literally cutting corners in the middle. Okay, that is the shape in the middle had no corners. Okay. Now, if you think about it, we are excited when we start on something. We are excited when we are about to finish, if there is a clear end. Okay? Sometimes we are not excited because we don't see this ever ending. But if there is a finish line, we are, again, excited and willing to work. If the middle is very long, that feels pointless. It's hard to feel like we are making progress. We lose our motivation to do it, and we lose our motivation to do it right. Now, when applying it to other people, their goals should probably have short middles. Okay, and of course, it depends on the child's developmental stage, but maybe 1 hour of homework has a middle that is just too long. Okay, maybe it needs to be broken to shorter units where you have 5 minutes of beginning, 5 minutes of end, and barely a middle. In our own life, there is a reason why most people don't set an annual exercise goal, right? Like you set a weekly or a daily exercise goal, because if it's an annual goal, there's too much of a middle.
Okay, you're going to lose thunder, yes.
Yeah, right. Saving for retirement is a challenge for, you know, most Americans, because the middle is our life. Do we really know?
That's such a profound statement. You're right. I think none of the saving is beneficial now. It's going to be beneficial in 40 years, but that's so long.
Yes, and so you try to make it into an annual saving goal, which is much better than a lifetime saving goal, because there is less of a middle. Try to make middle short for yourself or other people. Celebrate beginnings, celebrate ends. Often you do it just by breaking a goal into two sub-goals, right? So, you know, homework is a good example, because there is always homework, but how you structure this, how you think about this goal can be on an hourly basis, a daily basis, weekly, and so on.
No, and that's another point that you also make in the book, is that that the middle is so psychologically strenuous, and also literally strenuous, because it's been a while you have been at it. You also talk about then progress monitoring. You know, that I loved that you were talking about, you know, working towards accomplishing certain parts of your large sprawling task, going towards the 50% point, you can have a different internal dialogue. And once you cross over the midline, you can have a different dialogue, how close you are. Can you talk a little bit about, this is a great strategy, I feel, when educators or parents are working with children, helping them achieve these goals, again, which just takes time.
There are two ways to monitor progress. You can look back at what you have achieved, or you can look ahead at what is yet to achieve. And at any point, you can basically monitor progress in one way or another. Okay, like if you are pursuing a four-year college degree, you can say, I finished 1 year, I still have 3 years to go. Okay? In a loyalty program, you can say, well, I already made half of the purchases to win a reward, or I still need to make half of the purchases. So for basically every goal, you can monitor that, what we refer to as the glass half full, okay? Like how much progress have been achieved, or the glass half empty, how much progress is yet to be done. What I often see in education, and I don't have a representative sample, so it's just my observation, is that teachers tend to monitor progress in terms of what's left to be done, in terms of the glass half empty. Okay, this is where we are going. Okay, this is what's still missing. However, what we find in research is that for novices, for beginners, up until the 50%, if it's an all or nothing goal, it's usually more effective to look back and see that I've already done some. Okay, so instead of looking ahead and say I still have to do 90% of the work, look back and say I already done 10% of the work. The reason that this is often more effective is that when we look back, we learn that we can do it. Okay? When we think about what we accomplished in the past, that increases our confidence and therefore our commitment. And novices, beginners, are uncommitted. Okay? Which is why when they see what they have achieved, they say, well, I guess I can do it better than I expected. I guess that this is working. Once you are over the 50%, once you're an expert, then highlighting what's missing is actually more effective. To get your intuition, and we did many studies, some with Stacey Finkelstein, some with others on that, giving people this feedback on what they've accomplished, what's yet to be done. If you take someone who's just starting, a child that's just starting to learn how to play the piano, okay, I think that most people will have the intuition they should highlight what they did well and not their mistakes.
Yes.
Right. You should highlight their progress. So
they know nothing. So at least praise the effort to show up.
Exactly. Right. You showed up. Good for you. When you give feedback to a pianist, okay, an expert, then you often tend to focus on what's missing. Okay. You did not quite convey the emotion in like this part, you did not quite follow the tempo, but whatever is missing is more motivating for that person, and by the way also more informative because they got most of the stuff right. And we as feedback givers should be very attentive to focus on what has been accomplished when we are unsure about commitment and what is missing once commitment is established and the person is fully there.
So fascinating. You know, I can give an example. So I live next to a public park, and the round around the public park is 2.7 miles. And my goal is to walk 5 miles a day. And so I, of course, it is 2 miles away. I mean, not even 2 miles, maybe 1.5 miles away from my house. So if I walk my dog in my neighborhood, I can get a mile. And it just feels so good to have that jump start when I come to the park and begin my... So it doesn't feel like I'm starting and I have 2.7 miles only, because I just walking the dog itself, it just gives me a little boost. And then I feel like, whoa, if I do 2 rounds, it's like additional bonus. So I'm playing head games with myself. But I can literally see that my psychological attitude changes if I show up by already having walked my dog, because my Fitbit is showing me. And the second point that, you know, which you point out in the book, but I also have seen this trick so work, that marketing people really get this. They get motivations far more than people in education. Well, the Smoothie King near us gives us the card with 2 things punched already, and they want you to reach 10. So actually they want us to reach 8, but it feels like, oh my God, I have already achieved. And you talk a lot about this in the book. So I'm wondering in the context of the teaching, if the teachers can give actually 10% of the grade after the first class, saying you did in a great introduction class. So here, you now have only 90 points left to earn in this class, will be so much easier for the kids.
I love this example. Yes, I don't know if the teacher's doing this, but NEA, illusory progress, which is what marketing programs, loyalty programs often do, is very effective at getting people to persist. Okay, you've been already doing that. Okay? And so keep going. Okay, don't lose your streak. Okay? You're already in it, which is a fun way to kind of trick ourselves to think that we are already doing something so that we will feel more committed. On the other hand, some teachers have the wrong intuition of starting with negative feedback. How about I'll give you the first test that is very hard and you will see how much you need to learn in this class. And I see that and I'm like, oh no, what are you doing? Right? Like that. No, instead of giving something that's like easy, that allows for fast progress, like letting kids realize that they can do it before
having small wins.
Yeah. You start by giving negative feedback about everything that you still don't know, and you lose somebody's motivation. But anyway, it's one reason why approach goals also work better than avoidance goals.
Tell us a little bit the definition of these two goals, approach versus avoidance.
Yes, so approach avoidance are the do goals. Okay? It's to like do my homework, exercise, eat green vegetables, and so on. Do not goals are avoidance goals. Are everything they should not do. Okay, maybe I should not eat red meat. I should not stay late in bed. I should not daydream. I should not, I don't know, watch too much television. Right?
Eat the whole cake.
Yeah, right. Now, there are a few problems with avoidance goals. Okay, first, how do you know that you are successful? Well, you ask yourself, am I doing it? And by that, you bring this to mind. So it's like easy to show this with thought suppression. Okay, you try not to think about your ex. How do you know that you're successful at not thinking about your ex? You ask yourself, am I thinking about my ex? Well, yes. Right. So
isn't that the white bear problem?
Exactly. It's the white, it's Dan Wagner's white bear problem. But it's also like you ask yourself, like, am I successful cutting down on the red meat or on the TV? And now you're thinking about the foods and activities that you should not be doing. With kids, we see that also with adults, but even more with kids, with adolescents, that avoidance goals elicit reactants. So we all sometimes want to do something just because we are not allowed to do it. And with adolescents, that is spiking. There is a really nice line of studies by Chris Bryan, where he used psychological reactants to get kids to eat less junk food. And basically what he told adolescents is that marketers want them to eat junk food. Marketers design junk food to make them addictive. They make money from you eating junk food. Now, the adolescent that reads that is reacting, okay? Like, if they want me to do it, then I don't want to do it.
Yes.
And they were eating less junk food so that they are not going to play into this marketing ploy. We see that avoidance goals often are the goals that that kids reject. Okay? The kids say, I don't want to do it. I don't want you to tell me what not to do. It's much better if you recommend what I should do. And then the last thing is that avoidance goals are less intrinsically motivated. It's just not very exciting to cut down on your TV.
Okay? Exactly.
It's much more exciting to walk your dog, okay? Which would mean that you are cutting down on TV because you're outside walking your dog.
So true. So one quick question about that. So, you know, I see these kinds of mental hacks. I'm doing a little fake out with myself, you know, instead of telling myself, because then it becomes avoidance, don't watch TV. I'm saying, just go out, take your dog out. This is such a good self-discovery process. With children, when they don't have this metacognitive understanding about how, they don't think about their thinking, they may not even know, can I influence by telling them how to convert an avoidance goal into a approach goal?
Would that work in a similar way, like you were talking about in other places, how whatever works for us works for our children as well?
Yes. Well, what I meant is that whatever we apply on ourselves, we can apply for others. Okay.
So yeah, that's what I meant. Sorry.
I set approach goals for myself, I should also realize that I should set approach goals for my son who's 10-year-old. But you're asking a really important question, which is how much we can teach children motivation, how much we can teach them to motivate themselves. There is very little data on that. We know that self-control takes time to develop. It develops with age. So clearly a 10-year-old has better self-control than a 5-year-old and less self-control and probably general ability to motivate themselves than a 15-year-old. There is a general increase, but we know that it's still something that is being developed into the early 20s. And I know about a few studies that look into teaching kids motivation, measuring motivation, see that it predicts good life outcome. I believe that is possible and that we never try that on a large scale.
Yeah, I mean, this is your, I know you have lots of projects in the works, but this is something very interesting. I find that, conventional wisdom, for example, my mother, who is 80 years old, she lives with us and one of the, we make fun of it now, but she used to, kind of use this tactic on three of us, my older brother, younger brother, and myself. And she say, make your bed. People will say you are so amazing at making bed. And then she'll say, eat your broccoli. I mean, we didn't have broccoli in India, but karela, which is the worst vegetable you can ever eat. And she said, eat it. People will think you're the best karela eater. And so I found that my brother, and this is a like folklore of the house now, but when he was little, he would eat the vegetable and say to mom, would people say now I'm a great eater of this vegetable? And she said, yes. So it did work, like she used that as an influence, that people's perception of your capability as a motivator, and that worked. So I wonder, as we end, do you have any thoughts about social regulation of motivation? Do we find as an act of social cooperation, we tend to engage better with things even against our own will?
I love that you brought this story, because there are really four parts to motivation. There is setting a goal. There is striving toward this goal. We discussed monitoring progress. There is juggling goals. Okay, we discussed self-control. Okay, there are things that I want to do, and there are things that I should do. And in order to do these other things, I should not do the previous things on the list. And then the fourth element is social support. Okay, there is the role of others, and what do they say, and what do they think, and how do they help? And basically, most of the things that we do that are meaningful, that are big, we do with other people, okay, whether it's success at work, whether it's like for you, like producing this podcast, for me doing my research, it's always with other people. Starting a family is with other people. We work as a,
that's so
as
true.
A neighborhood, right? We work as a nation. And so leveraging social support is critical. If you are the only person who knows about your goal, and if no one else is there to help you, change that. Okay, find the people that you can share what you're working on with, and that you anticipate will be supportive. And maybe they just want you to be successful, and that's already huge support. Maybe they can actually help. Okay, maybe you can pull the rope together. Even if not, just them being there and watching you and hearing from you, I would be there, one of many people that remind our listeners that we are social animals, and so we We have to have the group's support. We are not loners. And to stay motivated, those around you need to know and to help.
Well, brilliant. This has been such a fascinating and engaging conversation. I really appreciate you being so generous with us. As we conclude, I often ask my guests if they have any recommendations of books that you have found fascinating, intriguing, informative, and that our readers can, listeners can benefit from reading.
So the field of motivation is actually exploding. There is so much work. There is Angela Duckworth's Grit book, Carol Dweck's Mindset, Wendy Wood wrote on Habit, Katie Milkman wrote on How to Change. And there is an explosion of ideas, and each of these
lovely
books illustrate some important lessons. And then don't forget to read fiction. Okay, there are so many amazing books that you could enjoy. Last thing about books, don't ever read a book because you have to. Okay?
So true. Do you have any Israeli, when you were a child, is there any Israeli author that influenced you as a child in fiction?
Yeah, I love to go back and think. I bet they do. I actually recently, she's not Israeli, she's Italian, but I was watching My Brilliant Friend, and that reminded me when I read these books by Elena Ferrante the first time, and how much I resonated with them, because she writes about women's friendship and about now, growing up in a place that is poor, that is non-academic, and then how the society, the people around you influence your pursuit, including your professional and academic pursuit. So I would say that influenced me a lot when it came out, but it still wasn't quite my childhood. It was later than that.
Wow, that's lovely. Well, thank you for sharing that. I think it's been a fabulous conversation. So, all right, that's all the time we have for today. Thank you again to Dr. Eilert Fischbach for being my guest. As you can see, these are incredibly important conversations we are having with highly knowledgeable, incredibly qualified and passionate experts who have managed their own motivation so well to inspire us to find our own a kind of switch that help us. Maybe switch is not a good analogy, but keep the pedal to the metal. And so lastly, as we close out, definitely subscribe to Full Prefrontal using your favorite listening app. Share the episode with as many people as you can, and reach out to us if you have any questions. So once again, thank you, Dr. Fischbach, for joining us, and see you again next week on Full Prefrontal.
Thank you for listening to Full Prefrontal, exposing the mysteries of executive function. To contact your host, Sucheta Kamath, and learn more about her work on improving executive function, visit her website at exqinfiniteknowhow.com. That's www.exqinfiniteknowhow.com. Tune in next week for another informative episode of Full Prefrontal, hosted by the founder of EXQ, Sucheta Kamath.